It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's almost a certainty that at some point during their time in office, presidents will have to address an issue involving the Constitution. How presidents have confronted and been shaped by this document is chronicled in the book, The Presidents and the Constitution, A Living History. I'm joined now in studio by the book's editor, newly appointed Duquesne University President Ken Gormley. Mr. Gormley previously served as Dean and Professor of Law at Duquesne and is the award-winning author of The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, a New York Times bestseller, and Archibald Cox, Conscience of a Nation. Ken Gormley, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's always a pleasure, Paul.
How did the idea for the presidents and the Constitution take hold, particularly in how this story is presented?
Well, I have to tell you, I've been thinking about it really for 10 years, and it just intrigued me. I've taught constitutional law my whole career, and it intrigued me that the presidency, which is probably the most powerful office in the world, is shaped by less than 1,000 words in the Constitution. And the framers purposely left a lot of it not filled out. And Alexander Hamilton, for instance, talked about the energy that had to fill that office with individual people. And so I wanted to tell a story, and it is a story that spans across presidencies to show how the presidencies are interconnected instead of just looking in isolation at clumps of presidential powers. That doesn't tell the stories. It's real people, it's real events pushing and tugging as history confronts individual people with circumstances. And that is how the powers of the presidency under the Constitution have been shaped and will be shaped.
So let's start at the beginning. You have George Washington, who, by virtue of being the first president, shaped the Constitution in a number of ways, not the least of which was appointing the entire first Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's a pretty good deal if you can get it, getting to appoint the entire Supreme Court, although FDR came close over his four terms. But it's interesting, Paul, because George Washington was also, even though he had enormous power at his disposal, very, very cautious. He did not want to look like a king or a despot. They had had enough of that. He didn't want to look like he was taking Congress's power away as a legislature. So he proceeded very cautiously, very deferentially. There's one great story in that chapter you probably saw. It's a good illustration of how the words don't tell you how it works. And so it says that the treaties are made with the advice and consent of the Senate. So George Washington goes into the Senate and has his vice president, John Adams, read off this proposed treaty, 15 points about the Sioux Indians. And the senators didn't know what to do, and they started shouting out questions and being disrespectful. And Washington got agitated and marched out, and things cooled. And 48 hours later, he came back and they got a treaty. But the point is, the Constitution didn't tell us. Now, Washington never went back and walked into the halls of Congress again to ask for advice and consent, nor has any president since then. But that is how it took people like George Washington to figure out how this document was going to work.
And so at that moment, he says, okay, this is not the right approach. We're going to have to go back to the drawing board. If you had to pick one president who had a most profound impact on the Constitution, who would you say it was? I know it's hard to pick one.
Yeah, it is hard to pick one. Obviously, Washington is one. Obviously, FDR is one because he was there so long and was so robust in his approach to it. But I would say probably Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he was a brilliant constitutional strategist. So you see in this chapter that the Emancipation Proclamation, one of the greatest proclamations in American history, if not world history, he did that under his commander-in-chief powers, because at that time, the slaves were still viewed as property. He had no means of just freeing them. And so he looked creatively at the document and used it. Also, brilliantly coming up with Lieber's Code, where he got this political scientist to draft a code of war, because he was a lawyer and he thought in terms of putting things down in rules to limit how you could use torture. He was afraid of how the African-American slaves would be treated by the Confederates. That Lincoln's Code, General Order Number 100, went on to form the basis for the Hague Conventions and, many of the great international treaties and codes of war that govern us still today. He was just brilliant, but obviously he also made some, you know, he blocked the southern ports without permission of Congress, without constitutional authority. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus. And you could say, wait a minute, that's not in the Constitution. And Lincoln's answer was, well, if we don't do these things, we won't have a constitution or a country left, so I'm going to do them. He was very, very careful, strategic, and creative in using the Constitution.
And I was going to ask you, with the country split as it was during the Civil War, that had to have created unusual and unprecedented leeway for a president, which Abraham Lincoln obviously recognized as a necessity in order to save the Union.
Yeah, and it was a tricky situation because you could make the argument that the states that seceded were no longer states, and so this was, you know, like conducting war abroad or whatever, or is it truly still part of the country, and are they governed by the Constitution? So he had to be very, very deft in figuring out how to handle this, and he navigated it brilliantly. If he had not been assassinated, most likely, he would have continued the path that he was going on with respect to freeing the, you know, the newly freed slaves in reality, not just in form. But unfortunately, that twist of events changed everything.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Duquesne University President Ken Gormley. He is the editor of a book that has just come out, and it is a fascinating read, The Presidents and the Constitution, A Living History. There are plenty of interesting and impactful things we learn about in this book about lesser-known presidents, including one Warren Gamaliel Harding, who, against the counsel of his advisors, commuted the sentence of a socialist that I'm sure a large segment of Americans have heard of, an activist named Eugene Debs, who ran for president and actually received millions of votes. Harding eventually frees this man, who is put in jail under an act created by Harding's predecessor, Woodrow Wilson, the Sedition Act. So let's talk first about what Wilson did and how he issued these extensive regulations relating to alien enemies and restricting their movements, which led to this Sedition Act and really amounts to an assault on free speech, right?
Right. Well, it's one of the first of many examples of our country really being very restrictive on First Amendment freedoms, almost to the point of being scary during times of war, during times of fear, hysteria. And so during World War I, Woodrow Wilson was very vigorous in advocating the sedition laws and laws that punished presumed subversives, socialists and others who were supposedly undermining the country and connected to the Bolshevik Revolution and other movements around the world. And so there was heavy-handed prosecution of American citizens for doing things like just handing out leaflets, advocating their views. And sadly, the Supreme Court, in major decisions like Schenck versus the United States, upheld that and developed a test, a kind of an infamous test now, the clear and present danger test. But during the Wilson presidency, people like Eugene Debs were jailed. People were treated as criminals for expressing views against the United States. And that was viewed as just part of what we do if we're at war. We see that played out again, obviously, during the FDR presidency and the tragedy of the Japanese internment camps. We see it again during the George W. Bush administration with a lot of decisions by the government to restrict rights like the NSA wiretap and things like that. So we see this as a pattern, and that's one of the things you see from this book is when there is fear and war and hysteria, we tend to restrict our rights in ways that really are dangerous to ourselves.
So all these hideous things are happening, and along comes Harding, who, against the counsel of his advisors, commutes the sentence of Debs. How did Harding repair the nation's commitment to the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights?
Well, it's a great chapter written by James Robinault, who's a great writer and lives in Ohio and has followed the Ohio presidents. We have a few of them, as you know. But Harding is a sort of unlikely hero, His wife counseled against it as well, commuting the sentence of Eugene Debs. But he felt that it was very important to send a signal right away that this was not going to be how we governed our country in the aftermath of the war. And so Eugene Debs was a symbol for so many people. He received, as you said, over a million votes while he's in jail. And so Harding arranged to have him come visit the White House before Christmas and just got permission for him to take a train to Washington, D.C., and to meet with him, and then released him from prison so that he could be home with his family by Christmas. A very powerful symbolism that we are going to change how we are applying our laws and the Constitution to our citizens. And it was a great gift that Harding gave, because it really rolled back and led the Supreme Court over time to rethink its position, I would say, on freedom of speech in our country. But if we hadn't had a war in Harding, and if we had had more people who took the position like Wilson, that we had to take a hard line, we would live in a totally different country today, I believe. You know, this was a very pivotal moment, and he preserved the free speech rights that were in that First Amendment, even during times of fear and hysteria.
Sadly, what Harding is best remembered for is the Teapot Dome scandal. Explain what this scandal involves and how it becomes the forerunner to modern special prosecutor investigations that we saw during the Nixon and Clinton administration.
The Teapot Dome scandal really had to do with an effort to defraud the government by a cabinet official of Warren Harding. And there's no evidence really substantiated that I've ever seen, and I've spent a lot of time on these special prosecutor cases that implicated Harding in it. But it really engulfed his presidency in scandal. And I think it really led to his death. Very honestly, he was distraught by that. As he said, you know, it's not my enemies who keep me awake at night. It's my friends. And, you know, this had been someone that he trusted. But we have the first modern special prosecutor investigation with Owen Roberts being one of the prosecutors looking into the Teapot Dome scandal. It goes on beyond Harding's administration. But interestingly, although it ended up really, you know, kind of being inconclusive with respect to, certainly Harding wasn't proven to be deeply involved, it sets the stage for Watergate. And that's one of the things I loved about working on this book, Paul, because I wanted to connect the threads and show, we don't usually do that. We look at presidents and laws in isolation. It's all connected over time. And so when you get to Watergate, and as you mentioned, I wrote the biography of Archibald Cox, the principled Watergate special prosecutor. They had nothing to go on when he started his job. Elliot Richardson appointed him, and they sat down and scribbled out notes on cocktail napkins, and that's how they came up with the rules that would govern them. But the other template that they had was the Teapot Dome scandal and how that special prosecutor office had sort of been organized, and the fact that it could bring in witnesses and gather evidence and all of that. And that has in many ways haunted modern presidents as you go through Iran-Contra with Reagan and Bush, you know, the first President Bush. And then you get to obviously the Clinton scandals and investigations, and even, you know, Scooter Libby and George W. Bush, and constant calls for special prosecutors in President Obama's time, although none have stuck. And then even calls for special prosecutors this week with respect to candidate Secretary Hillary Clinton. It's part of our culture now to be suspicious, distrustful, and this era of special prosecutors is still kind of haunting all leaders, because it can be used to just pull them out of office if they make a fatal misstep.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Ken Gormley. He is the editor of the book, The Presidents and the Constitution, A Living History. And there are a lot of interesting things that we learn in this book, one of which is that Lyndon Baines Johnson's first job was illegally practicing law. How did that happen?
Yeah, it was funny. He actually went to California. He thought he wanted to be a lawyer, went to California. He had a cousin or uncle who was practicing law there, who ended up being a womanizer and an alcoholic, I believe. And so young Lyndon had to take over a lot of his clients. And then as more and more responsibility was being put on his shoulders as a teenager without a law license or legal training. He figured, boy, this probably isn't a good path. He went back to Texas, began teaching, didn't like that, went to law school for a year in Washington. It was too monotonous for him. He wanted the action of politics, and that's the course he chose.
And so, of course, he gets on the ticket with Kennedy. Kennedy wins the presidency in 1960, and LBJ ends up impacting the Constitution profoundly by carrying out John Kennedy's plan to make civil rights and voting rights the law of the land. Explain how LBJ does this.
Well, LBJ did it by using the death of JFK, who he wasn't particularly close with, as you know, nor with Bobby Kennedy, but he used it to get the public support to put pressure on Congress, and he was a master politician, as you know, to push through the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the greatest civil rights legislation of our history, and also the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But he did it, and this is where Archibald Cox and the Bobby Kennedy philosophy came in. He did it in a very shrewd way, using the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And this can sound boring, but, you know, the Commerce Clause was talked about a lot with the Affordable Care Act. If you look at threads in these presidencies, Paul, over time, the Commerce Clause ends up being one of the most important provisions in the entire Constitution. And presidents have wielded it very effectively. And here, because of these terrible decisions from the Supreme Court after the Civil War during Reconstruction that undercut the civil rights laws that Congress tried to pass after Lincoln was assassinated, they couldn't rely on that precedent. Archibald Cox had been a labor lawyer, knew the Commerce Clause inside and out. That didn't require state action in order to do it. And it also, well, it could require state action, but it gave the government, Congress, wide berth in order to exercise its powers. And so that's what LBJ was smart enough to rely on. And also by using the Commerce Clause, it had an appeal to the Southerners because he could argue, well, this is good for everyone. It's good for our wallets. And just put the racial issue aside. And using that, he managed to pass the most significant civil rights legislation, which is still governing us today. It's tragic, though. You see, he died unhappy, unpopular, crushed, really, because of the Vietnam War. He played that one unsuccessfully. And that's the other story about the presidents in the Constitution. Some of them end up being heroes because of how they acted. Even Truman, for instance, in hindsight, even though he was unpopular when he left for trying to seize the steel mills, ends up looking good. Of course, he had a great biographer, David McCullough, from Pittsburgh, and that helped him. But it's so interesting to see legacies can shift and turn, and someone who's on the top of the world at one moment can end up at the bottom, and that's a fascinating piece of the story.
Before we wrap up, this book addresses the national security presidency under George W. Bush and Barack Obama. How does 9/11 impact the presidency, their presidencies, but ultimately the presidency as we know it today and the Constitution?
Well, it was obviously one of the biggest shifts in, you know, the dynamic of how presidents could interact with the Constitution. George W. Bush had enormous power at his disposal after that attack. Interestingly, in the chapter, you see he kind of overplayed his hand because the public was behind him, the courts were behind him, but he was pushing the power of the presidency, and not for himself, the author makes it clear, but for the presidency itself. He wanted to make it so powerful he exceeded his authority when it came to Guantanamo and enemy combatants and all sorts of things. But we see an enormous power of the presidency, the NSA wiretaps. His wrists were slapped, and I testified in the Senate at that time. However, what resulted was still very potent legislation protecting the president's power to protect us from outside terror threats. And a lot of people are surprised by this, perhaps, but President Obama has really continued that path fairly strongly, although he's a lawyer, a constitutional lawyer, unlike President Bush, and I think he understood the nuances more, carefully and executed on them much more carefully. But when it comes to drones and all these issues that face us into the future,
the Edward Snowden issues.
Yeah, exactly. It's all happening in real time, Paul, and we're watching it come happen in front of us. So that's a biggie. The other issue, if you want to see the biggest issue that has really haunted our country from its start, and it's ironic, we're sitting here this week with the president just having given a speech about the tragedy in Dallas and around the country. It's race. You see it from the beginning from Washington. You see it threading its way through with the three-fist clause that allowed the slave owners to control who was elected president until after the Civil War. You see it into modern times, Plessy v. Ferguson. It is frightening when you see that. And an interesting little tidbit I'll leave you with is if you go to the presidency of Franklin Pierce, you see Bleeding Kansas, where people flocked into Kansas and killed each other to try to determine whether this would be a slave country or a free country. Well, Kansas is where Barack Obama's family came from. His parents, who were white, as you know, and his mother and his grandparents, they moved to Hawaii, and I have seen the birth certificate. But it is Bleeding Kansas that produced the first African-American president, and yet we are still fighting over these things all these years later. And that's a sobering reminder that if we are going to be a country that really is premised upon equal justice for all citizens, that is something we have to address.
It is a fascinating book. We've been talking about The Presidents and the Constitution, A Living History, edited by my guest, Ken Gormley, who is the president of Duquesne University, previously served as dean and professor of law at Duquesne, and other books by him that you might want to check out that he's written, The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, and also Archibald Cox, Conscience of a Nation. Ken Gormley, great thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Paul. It's a fabulous show. It's one of the great radio shows in Pittsburgh, so it's an honor to be here with you.
Well, thank you very much for those sentiments. I appreciate it. When we come back from the break, Post-Gazette political cartoonist Rob Rogers has curated the exhibit This Campaign is Huge, currently on display at the Toonzeum, a humorous take on the 2016 race for the White House.
The idea was to cover the whole campaign, you know, the primary when it was 16 candidates and Hillary and Bernie. And so even though I warned the cartoonist that I was asking for work, I was saying, don't send me all Trump. But I did get a lot of Trump. And that's fine because it's good stuff.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.